This conference is being recorded.
Hello, this is Mitchell Levy from Happy About, and I am excited today to have Marshall Goldsmith, the preeminent coach, I believe, in the world to CEOs and others, talking about his latest book. Marshall, great to have you today.
Happy to be here.
So just thought I'd let people know that we will run the conversation for about a half hour, both Marshall and I going back and forth, and then we'll save 25 minutes at the end for Q&A. So at any point in time, feel free to send questions to info@happyabout.info. Or after the half hour mark, you can hit the *6 and allow yourself to be unmuted. Anyhow, what was really fun about this project, and let me give you a little bit of background, and then you and I can talk about the book, was I had called Marshall probably, 5-6 weeks before the book Mojo came out, published by Hyperion. And I said, you know, we should do something together. And I've got this new book series called Think Aha. And with that series, we can actually produce books really quickly. And Marshall, you said, well, can you do it as quickly as a couple of weeks? And we said, that's a great challenge. Let's make it happen. And so we basically ghost wrote with you Mojo Tweet, made it available, put it on the supply chain, and put it out there within, a 4 to 5 week period, and also got approval from Hyperion to make that happen. And it was absolutely a ton of fun. And so I once again want to thank you publicly for making that happen with us.
Well, thank you. You guys did a great job.
Oh, thanks. So when we talk today, we're going to talk a little bit about Mojo Tweet, but we're going to sort of combine both books. And both books are available. Mojo and Mojo Tweet are both available on Amazon through book channels. For Mojo Tweet, it's available also on the Happy About and the Think Aha, so thinkaha.com website. But let's just start off of why Mojo? What got you thinking about this? And we'll talk about the success afterwards, but just, real quickly, why was this the place you wanted to start moving?
Well, I've done sessions at my house with retiring CEOs, and we talk about, what's important in life, what matters, what doesn't matter. And we've come up with five basic keys to having a good life. The first one is health. If you don't have your health, the rest of the stuff doesn't mean a whole lot. The second one is wealth. And we find that wealth in the United States really only is related to happiness once you get to the $65,000 to $80,000 a year level. After that, increased wealth statistically doesn't have anything to do with increased happiness. There's an interesting study on this called Stumbling on Happiness, a good book. It talks about people who win the lotteries. A year or two later, they're not that much happier. So wealth matters to a point, but not much beyond that point. Rich people are not less happy, nor are they more happy. The third factor is relationships. Very important to have positive relationships with people that we love, friends, family, respectful relationships with people at work. And most of my previous work focused on building relationships. Then the only other two factors that seem to matter are happiness and meaning. Am I doing something that makes me happy? And am I doing something that is meaningful for me? And the only person can define happiness or meaning for any of us is us. Nobody can tell you what makes you happy but you. Nobody can tell you what is meaningful for you but you. So one thing about Mojo is this is a book that focuses more on the intrapersonal, whereas the rest of my work focused more on the interpersonal.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And what's been the success so far? I mean, it was bestseller status on Amazon, New York Times. Why don't you just talk about that a little bit?
Well, the book is doing great. I mean, I think it's already sold about 50,000 copies, which, if you know anything about books, 93% of all books sell 1,000 copies or less. So the book is already a big success. It's been a New York Times bestseller, Wall Street Journal, it was number 3, and today it's number 1 in China. So I think the book will end up selling a lot of copies because it's not really a topical book. I mean, it's not like Henry Paulson's book, which is really popular for a few weeks, but, 6 months from today, nobody's going to buy it. It's a book that's more more lasting, I believe. So my book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, has been in Inc. magazine, CEO Reads business bestseller, top 10 bestseller 3 years in a row. So, you know, I don't know if Mojo will sell at that level, but I think it's going to be very, very successful.
Got it. So it's been real well. And for those that are listening, we created the book called Mojo Tweet, which is...
By the way, that sold great, too.
And that was actually sold quite well as well. And it's basically comprised of 140 tweets. So when you hear us talk about tweet numbers as part of this, these are the tweets in the book. Mm-hmm. And for those that, if you got an iPhone, why don't you, right now, you can actually go to the iPhone and download an application called Think Aha, THINKAHA. And actually, MojoTweet downloads with Think Aha. And so you could actually start reading the Think Aha book immediately, and both the book and the application is free.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I had a question for you. So I'm reading this, and there's an acknowledgement, and the acknowledgement is to the Buddha.
Hmm.
And I don't know if you remember that, but tell me the thought process. I mean, I guess it goes along with the answer to your first question, but just sort of what went behind. I mean, there's so many things you can do when you acknowledge somebody in a book. Why the Buddha?
Well, I'm a Buddhist. And, I'm a Buddhist. Now, there are many schools of Buddhist thought. So when someone says they're a Buddhist, it's not that particularly helpful to you because you're not sure exactly what that means. So there are many schools of Buddhist thought. My school of Buddhism is a very simple school. Be happy now. This is heaven. This is hell. This is nirvana. It's not on the outside. It's on the inside. And the essence of life is find happiness and meaning where you are, not someplace else. So... I'm a Buddhist, and this is kind of basically a Buddhist philosophy, and there's a lot of Buddhism in the book.
I would say there's a ton of Buddhism in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. So if you, for those that...
By the way, speaking of Mojo Tweet, right
yeah.
now in terms of the Kindle books, it's the number two job hunting book on Amazon.
Not bad. Thank you for sharing.
No, it's doing great. And again, it's really popular in Kindle. So the Mojo Tweet book is a very, very popular book on Kindle. And in fact, right now on Kindle, of all the career books, it's number 8. My other book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, is number 7. So
oh,
I'm looking at the top 10 of Kindle. And in terms of career books, we have number 7 and number 8.
It's a goal to be 1 through 10 or 1 through 5, but 7.
By the way,
not
that I would be a compulsive author who constantly looks these things up, but other authors do that all the time.
I have to say it. with over 100.
By the way, the only authors that say they don't look up all these best-selling numbers are liars.
That's true. Well, some do it more than others, we'll have to say.
Oh, yeah, we all do it.
It's always a constant
Anyone
email.
That writes bestsellers does it, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah.
The ones that don't do it
in the morning. Here
the ones
we are.
That don't do it, their books don't sell any copies.
So for those that don't know you, I have an incredible respect for who you are and what you do. But for those that don't know you, can you just give us a little bit of background of who you are, and the types of clients you work with, the things that you do, because it's really quite impressive.
Well, my name is Marshall Goldsmith. I'm from Kentucky. I went to school in Indiana. I got a PhD at UCLA. I was a college professor at Loyola. I was a dean when I was very young. I've been doing executive education for 33 years. So I do three things. One is I teach classes and give keynote speeches, and I teach at many schools, Dartmouth, Michigan, a lot of the top business schools. But I only teach executive ed. I don't grade papers. And then the next thing I do is I do executive coaching. Executive coaching is what I'm most famous for. My coaching clients are CEOs or could be CEOs of multi-billion-dollar corporations. And if you look at my book, you'll see who my clients are because they're kind enough to write their names in the books. So my coaching clients are really neat people. And I have a very unique approach to coaching. I don't get paid if my clients don't get better. And better is not judged by me or them. It's judged by everyone around them. So my coaching process is very unique and very different. And I help people achieve. I work with very successful people and try to help them achieve positive long-term change in behavior. So that's pretty much what I do for a living. Then the third thing I do is write and edit books and articles. And I've done a whole bunch of books. The biggest selling book I wrote is called What Got You Here Won't Get You There. That was a Harold Longman Award, Wall Street Journal number one bestseller, business book of the year. So that book's done great, been translated into 29 languages. So I do three things. I do speaking, coaching, and writing. Speaking is what I enjoy doing the most. That's the most fun for me. Coaching is where I learn the most. I learn so much from my clients. Almost everything I write about, I learn through coaching. And then writing is how I reach people. And my website, www.marshallgoldsmithlibrary.com, I've had people from 195 countries look at 4.2 million different things from that website, or 4.2 million times they've looked at something from that website.
Amazing. You've done really well. More good things to come.
Life is good.
Actually, isn't that your, every time I get an email from you, I think that's your automatic default signature tag, life is good.
Life is good.
Hey, so tweet number two,
mm-hmm.
The only person who can define meaning and happiness for you is you.
Very important because my daughter Kelly and I did a survey, Mojo survey, and that's at mojothebook.com. We did this survey. And in our survey, we asked people to talk about happiness and meaning. And they talked about what percent of their lives are spent doing things that make them happy or engaged in activities they find as meaningful, both at work and outside of work. And what we found is it's really not a function of the activity. It's a function of the person, the activity, and time. For example, outside of work, gardening. We had these various categories, one called surviving. Surviving, low amounts of happiness and low amounts of meaning. Sacrificing, low amounts of happiness, high amounts of meaning. Stimulating, low amounts of meaning, high amounts of happiness. Sustaining, kind of moderate amounts of both. And then succeeding, which is the Mojo box, high amounts of happiness and meaning. And we'd ask people to describe activities in their lives that were in each box. And for example, gardening. Gardening scored everywhere. Some people found it to be a meaningless drudge. Other people found it very meaningful and it made them happy. Well, there's nothing inherently good or bad about gardening. It's just, what do you bring to gardening? And I use a lot of examples in the book. A classic case study is flight attendants, where you can see Mojo. I fly all the time. On American Airlines alone, I have over 10 million frequent flyer miles. Well, flight attendant is a great place to observe Mojo. One flight attendant is positive, upbeat, motivated, enthusiastic. The other flight attendant is negative, bitter, angry, and cynical. They're both on the same plane at the same time doing the same job. The difference is not what's on the outside, it's what's on the inside. I had a great experience last week. I was flying somewhere, and I sat next to a retired flight attendant. We were talking about the book, and I said, I mentioned flight attendants. She said, I love being a flight attendant. Every day I loved it. And she said, every day I got on that plane, let's say for a three-hour flight, you know what I said? This is my ministry. I am going to show by word and deed how a good person should be living to the people who are sitting on this airplane. I thought, wow, that's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. Well, she was a flight attendant. I use an example in the book of a person putting on roofs that I was with when I was 14 years old. We were poor. We had to put a roof on my house and couldn't afford to do it, but had to do it. So my dad asked me to help this man put on the roof, and I had an attitude problem. I was 14. It was hard work. But the guy's name was Dennis Mudd. He was so motivated and enthusiastic, he got me all motivated and enthusiastic. And then after the roof got put on, my dad's name is Bill Goldsmith. He looked at my dad and he said, Bill, look at that roof. I want you to inspect it. If that's of high quality, pay me. If it's not, it's all free. I looked at Dennis Mudd. Dennis Mudd was poor. And I thought, you know what? This man may be poor, but he's not cheap. This guy's got class. I thought, I want to be like Dennis Mudd when I grow up. My whole coaching thing of pay only for results came from Dennis Mudd. And Dennis Mudd has more class than I do because, you know, if I don't get paid, my life's still going to go on. Dennis Mudd needed the money. And I was so impressed with what he did. Well, Mojo is something you can see in all different occupations, from great leaders to flight attendants to people who are putting on roofs.
Wow. I don't think I've heard that story before. I love it. That's great. It was kind of funny. I sat down. I've read your book a couple times so far. And when I sat down to read your book to think about, okay, what's important? You know, what do I start taking notes. when I completely filled up the front and back side of a yellow, you know, of a piece of paper, I'm thinking, oh man, I'm taking way too many notes. So, you know, the thing that's interesting is there's 140 ahas in the book, and almost all of them are important. But let me give you another one. It's number 7. Mojo is the moment when you do something that's purposeful, powerful, passionate, and the rest of the world recognizes it. So give me a little bit about the rest of the world stuff, because, you know, it's interesting. I started to think about a saying, and that is, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, did it really fall? And so the rest of the world recognizing it, tell me what you think about. What does that really mean?
Well, I define mojo as that positive spirit toward what you are doing now that starts from the inside and radiates to the outside. The rest of the world recognizing it, that's a big part of our mojo. People can see it, like the flight attendant or like Dennis Mudd or like the great leaders I work with. Mojo is something that the rest of the world can see. While we're doing it, we communicate it to others. And by the way, that's very, very important for leaders, to communicate to others that this work makes me happy. This work is meaningful for me. A critically important message for leaders to communicate. Because think of the message that we send if we don't do that. Well, being around you and this company makes me miserable. And by the way, this is meaningless. Not particularly motivational to the people around us.
Well, actually, you just answered or addressed tweet number 13, which is, mojo is infectious. When people pass their positive spirit to us, we feel like passing it back.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, actually, I agree with you. It's really, when people call me up and I'm telling them how great things are working, all of a sudden they're very interested in hearing more, and then they want to share back. And and I do agree. And so it's kind of fun. We have another author, Kevin Eikenberry.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin's sort of same way, everything he does, he did a book with us called Leadership Tweet, everything he does is focused on the positive and the positive spirits coming back. Give me another nice mojo story. I love the flight attendant is a fun one. Give me another story.
Well, you know, in mojo we talk about positive case studies and we also talk about negative case studies. Because I think it's important to look at what mojo isn't. And the word I use for that is nojo, that negative spirit toward what you're doing that starts on the inside and radiates to the outside. And, you know, we all see that every day just as well. So we see both people who are very positive and upbeat and motivated and enthusiastic, and we see people who don't care and clearly communicate the fact that they don't care to everyone around them. So I think if you look at the concept of mojo, it's important to look at it both from the positive perspective, what people are doing right, and from the negative perspective, what people aren't doing right, what people are doing wrong. So I think, you know, both are very important, and both are what we see as we go through life every day.
Yeah, it's, which one is it? Oh, yeah, it's tweet number 19. A negative spirit starts from the inside and radiates the outside. People with a negative spirit have no joy.
Yep.
And so I have to tell you, you're going to like this. So one of my staff members and I, of course, we've read your book a number of times. In our conversation, it went like this. Hey, this person we're working with has nojo. How do we fix that?
Well, one thing you can do in coaching is, one thing I suggest in this book that's very different to increase employee engagement is, rather than the company saying, what can we do to fix you? Really challenge that person to ask a question, what can you do to fix yourself? Because back to the two flight attendants, they're both on the same time. You know, what can you do to fix yourself? And for example, I define mojo as people that take responsibility. Nojo, play the victim. Mojo, nojo, march in place. Mojo, run the extra mile. Nojo, satisfied with the bare minimum. Mojo, inspirational. Nojo, painful to be around. Mojo, caring. Nojo, indifferent. Mojo, zest for life. Nojo, zombie-like. Mojo, awake. Nojo, asleep. So we can all kind of look at people every day that we deal with and see both mojo and nojo. And I think it's real important to challenge people, what can you do to change yourself? Now, let me tell you another couple of apps that we use. I'm often asked a question, do I have a coach? Answer, yes. I have a peer coach. And there's a process that I use that I think is I talk about in the book that's fantastic. It's called the Daily Question Process. By the way, if any of you would like to get my daily questions, send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com. I'll send them to you. The Daily Question Process, I have my coach is Jim Moore. He calls me up and he says, 24 questions he asked me. Every question, yes, no, or a number. We did this for about a year and a half. It's amazing how well it works. I'll share some of my questions. First question, on a 1 to 10 scale, how happy were you yesterday? On a 1 to 10 scale, how meaningful was yesterday? How many minutes did you walk? How many push-ups did you do? How many sit-ups did you do? Did you say or do something nice for your wife or your son or your daughter? All these basic questions about life, and it is shocking how well this process works. Well, what I learned is even once a day is not enough. You need to kind of do it even more. One of the tools that we have in the free applications at mojothebook.com is called the Mojo Meter. And the way it works is, and I have it on my iPhone, but you can also put it on your BlackBerry, as you go through the day, it just gives you constant questions. How happy was I during this activity, and how meaningful was this? And you constantly go through life challenging yourself. Now, let me give you an example. Let's imagine you have to go to a meeting, a boring meeting, a stupid meeting, PowerPoint slides. You don't want to go. You're dreading it. Option A, you can go to that meeting and be miserable and make everyone else around you miserable. Or option B, you can say, if I knew I had to evaluate myself on a 1 to 10 scale on happiness and meaning, what could I do to increase my happiness and what could I do to increase the amount of meaning I experienced at that meeting? Well, my theory is if you knew you're going to have to evaluate yourself, you'd start getting creative and doing things better. I've asked thousands of people, what are some of the things you could do to get better? And people come up with all kinds of creative ideas. Well, it's amazing. If we just challenge ourselves to increase our own amount of happiness and our own amount of meaning, we can improve. And again, our default reaction in life is not to experience happiness or meaning. It's just experience inertia. We all tend to do what we've been doing, go where we've been going, and say what we've been saying. One of the challenges that Mojo points out is break the spell of inertia and start challenging yourself on a regular basis about what can I be doing right now to increase the amount of happiness I'm experiencing in my life. What can I be doing right now to make my life more meaningful?
So that's the, I was actually going to sort of steer in the direction is for those listening, for those who are thinking to themselves, man, I need to beef up my mojo. What are some other things you recommend? What do you think people should be focused on thinking about?
Well, I talk about four building blocks of mojo. The first one is identity. Our identity is how do we define ourselves? And mojo is very much impacted by our identity. If mojo is that positive spirit toward what you are doing now that starts on the inside and radiates to the outside, well, who's the you and you? Our identity comes from several sources. One is our remembered identity. It's what we remember about our past. How do you know you're a bad tennis player? Remember losing. The next is our reflected identity. That's what other people told us about ourselves. Somebody told us you're a bad listener. Well, how do we know we're a bad listener? Somebody in the past told us we were. Part of it is our programmed identity. And this is very powerful, and it's what we end up becoming based on programs from others. For example, my mother went to college for 2 years. My father had a two-pump gas station back in Valley Station, Kentucky. When I was growing up, my mother didn't want me to end up working at the gas station. What did she tell me about myself as a child? She said, you have no mechanical skills, and you will never have any mechanical skills for the rest of your life. So she gives me this program, you have no mechanical skills. I'm never encouraged to be around cars or tools or mechanical things, so I don't learn. Well, you know, I'm 18 years old. I take a test to go to the United States Army called the United States Army Aptitude Test. I scored in the bottom 2% of the whole United States. I scored below random chance. Well, now it was not my mother saying this or my mother, my father, and my friends. It was the Army. I was a trained psychologist. It wasn't until I'm 26 years old and getting a PhD at UCLA that I questioned this. I take a class from old Dr. Tannenbaum. He said, what do you do well? What do you need to do better? I said, well, what do I do well? Scholarly pursuits, research. What was I saying? Smart. What do you need to do better? I have no mechanical skills. I will never have any mechanical skills. He said, Marshall, how do you know you have no mechanical skills? I said, it's hopeless. I took a test. He said, how's your mathematical skills? Oh, I got a perfect score on the SAT math achievement test. 9 courses of math past calculus. Great mathematical skills. He said, why is it you can solve complex mathematical problems, but you can't solve simple mechanical problems? I started thinking. He said, how's your hand-to-eye coordination? I said, I can shoot pool, play pinball games, drink beer. He said, why is it you can shoot pool and play pinball, but you can't hammer nails? When I was 26 years old, I realized I had no mechanical skills because I had an identity that I had no mechanical skills. I told myself that over and over, and it became true. There was no logical reason for this. I see this every day in my coaching. I'll work with top executives that say things like, I can't listen. I look in their ears. Why not? You get something stuck in there? I can't give recognition. Well, why not? We limit ourselves and our identities, often unnecessarily. And then the final element of our identity is what I call our created identity. And that's what Mojo is all about. How can we create a new, more positive identity for ourselves? And I use the example of having dinner with Bono, the famous rock and roll star. It was a great experience. We had dinner together, and he talked about his identity. His original identity was a regular guy, and he's still a regular guy. He doesn't act pretentious. He used the F word about every third word. He apologized. He said, I'm sorry, I shouldn't swear so much, sir. I said, listen, don't worry. Where I was brought up, we thought that was the adjective that preceded all nouns. He was a regular guy. He's still a regular guy. He became a rock and roll fan. He's still a rock and roll fan. He talked about the bands he loved and listening to music. Then he became a musician. He's still a musician. He talked about loving music, not just to make money, but because he loved doing it. Then he became a rock star. Then he talked about what life was like as a rock star, and he didn't do that to be pompous, but that's who he is. And now he's a humanitarian. He talked about how he became a humanitarian, why he was a humanitarian, how much that meant to him, trying to help other people. He wasn't a fake humanitarian. He's a real humanitarian. So he uses an example of him as an example in the book of a person who was able to change the activity they're getting that high mojo from. So identity is an important part. Reputation, I talk about that. That's how other people see us. Other elements of mojo that I talk about are achievement. And I talk about achievement from two dimensions, which are a little different. One is, what does this activity give to me? Two, what am I giving to it? And historically, we've looked at activity only in terms of what am I giving to it? Am I motivated? Am I able? Do I know what to do and how to do it? Do I have confidence? Am I authentic? What am I giving it? Well, in the book, I talk about a different perspective on achievement. Ask yourself, what does this activity give to me? Does it make me happy? Is it fulfilling or meaningful? Do I get rewards that are important to me? Am I grateful for the opportunity to do this? Well, it's a different way to look at achievement. And then finally, we look at acceptance. And the key on acceptance is, you know, changing what you can, making peace with what you can't. And a lot of the book, I talk about, you know, some Buddhist philosophy of acceptance and what I learned from Peter Drucker on that. So those are four key factors we look at in terms of mojo.
Yeah, so you're talking about largely is let's do things we like to do. Let's do things that make us happy. Let's do things that help make the people around us happy. And if we could do all that while sort of living life, making money and doing what we do, then we've lived a life with a nice existence.
Exactly. And let's one other dimension, though. Let us do what is meaningful to us. Again, nobody can define meaning for you but you. Nobody can define meaning for me but me. In writing the book Mojo, it's kind of reflective of, as I've grown older, a goal I have in life. My goal is just to help people have a little bit happier and more meaningful life. And again, other people's goal might be, for example, stop global warming. Well, I'm not against that at all, and, you know, God bless them, and or save the environment, or any number.
No, we got Al Gore for that one, so.
Well, there are any number of big, important things, right, which if other people want to do those, you know, I'm feeling, you know, knock yourself out, that's a good thing. I'm getting older, pretty much not going to save the entire world by myself. I've decided I just want to help the people that read my stuff and go to my classes or people I coach or meet. Help them have a better life and help the people around them have a better life. Well, I don't dump that on anybody else. That's just what I'm trying to do. If other people want to do other things, they might consider what I do reasonably meaningless. Well, that's okay. It's not my, their life is not my life.
So if I go back to the question I asked at the beginning, you know, why this book? I think you've answered it from the perspective, as long as I've known you, you've always been this way. You've always given out to others, been great at what you do, and defined meaning in the way that you've described in the book. Now you're just sharing that with others. And mm-hmm. So I'll say thank you.
Well, thank you.
I think I'll do one or more questions, and then I'm getting some questions on email. If you have questions, feel free to send them once again to info@happyaboutthatinfo. And after we do one more dialogue, we'll then open up the mics for those who want to ask.
Okay.
I think I go back and forth on what's the most important, one of the things that stick out, this is one of your catchphrases. You've got it in tweet number 132. Name it, frame it, claim it. Naming what we can do can help us enhance how we do it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could talk a little bit more about that for those.
Well, I mean, I'll give you an example. As a professional, my mission is to help successful leaders achieve positive, lasting change in behavior for themselves, their people, and their teams. That's all I do. That is my identity. Well, I think if we can name what we do, frame it in a way that's meaningful for us, and then say, this is who we are, claim it, we're much more likely to be effective or successful. And I mentioned simple examples like naming parts of the day, how that can change the way we view that part of the day, or naming our relationship with other people. And I use funny examples, positive examples, but Peter Drucker always asks a few basic questions. Number one, what's the mission? Number two, who's the customer? Number three, what does the customer consider value? Number four, what's the goal? And number five, what's the plan? Simple, simple questions. He was a very simple man in many ways. Brilliant man, yet a simple man. Peter Drucker says you should be able to write your mission on a T-shirt. And I'll never forget one day I had the opportunity. I said, Peter, you're always talking about other people's missions and goals. What's your mission? He said, my mission is to help other people achieve their objectives. He said, assuming they're not immoral or unethical. And he was in his 90s. He started laughing. He said, at my age, I don't really care if they're illegal. What are they going to do to me anyway? Well, pretty straightforward stuff. You know, very simple. That's what he's trying to do. And, you know, I'm just trying to help people achieve positive long-term change in behavior, have more happy and meaningful lives, and the people around them have more meaningful lives. And even if you're the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company, you know what? You still want to have a happy and meaningful life. They're not any different than anybody else.
I agree wholeheartedly. As a matter of fact, he started thinking when you were telling your story before about growing up and being sort of pre-programmed.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to sort of share something with anyone who's listening who's a parent. Because there's one thing, we grew up terribly poor, and there's one thing that my mom did, and she looked at me and said, you could do whatever you want, you just need to set your mind to it.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, so she sort of set this sort of mojo thing. Now, we you know, she didn't put me on any path. She didn't know where to put me or what to do, but she did sort of give me that ability. And I'm trying really hard with my son to do the same thing. And it makes such a difference when we're not putting these artificial boundaries around our children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great, one great takeaway from this is not only are you influencing yourself and those you work with, but also your family.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a lot of sense. So willing to have people come online and ask questions. If you want to unmute yourself, you press the *6. And while people are coming online, Marshall, what haven't we talked about so far? What message from your book would you like to communicate?
Well, I think another message that's very important in the area of acceptance, and this sounds very simple. It's something else I learned from Peter Drucker. And this point I'm going to make sounds obvious. Very few people get it. Every decision in the world is made by the person who has the power to make the decision. Make peace with that. I'm not the best person or the smartest person or the right person or the pretty person, the person who agrees with you. It's made by that person. Once we make peace with this seemingly obvious point, life gets a lot better. And we quit going through life saying it's not fair or it's not right. That person is the customer. If we influence that person, we make a difference. If we don't, we don't. So I think that's a very, very important point in the book. And I talk about what you can do to influence that person and what to do if you cannot influence that person. By the way, one other point that I think is very important in 2010, good coaching advice for 2010, before you speak, before you act, you breathe, and you ask yourself one question. Is what I'm about to say or do in the best interest of myself and the people that I love? If the answer is no, it may not be a great year to say it or do it. 2010, I find it's not a good year to make ego points. The economy's too bad.
That's an understatement.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Mark, I got a question, Mitch.
Please.
Marshall,
hey, by the way,
John.
Can you say who you are?
Sure, Marshall. It's John Gale. I really enjoyed your book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. That was fantastic.
Thank you very much.
In terms of this conversation, what would you say is the easiest way for somebody to look at themselves and try to pick themselves up and take them up to the next level in terms of where they are?
Well, first is, I think it's very good to look in yourself and ask yourself, what do I want? Not what does the rest of the world say I should want, what do I want? What is my goal? What do I want out of life? Set goals. Then you have to face the reality of the marketplace. And here's one thing I teach everybody, get real offers. Get real offers where you are, get other offers. Go out there and work real hard to get real offers, because you can always say no, but you can't say no to offers you don't get. I think offers are uniformly good things. And think like a good salesperson. And an interesting point that few people realize, the great salesperson does not get rejected less. The great salesperson gets rejected much more, but the great salesperson asks for the order a lot more. Just get out there, be willing to ask for the order, put yourself into the really great positive salesperson, sell what you can sell, and then the other hand is make peace with what you can't sell. What you can't change, just learn to take a deep breath and make peace. I'll get to an interesting statistic in the book. I've asked thousands of people around the world this question. What percent of all interpersonal communication time is spent on A, people talking about how smart, special, or wonderful they are, or listening to somebody do that, plus B, people talking about how bad, stupid, or inept someone else is, or listening to people do that? The average answer from the entire world, and it doesn't vary much from country to country, 65%. One thing I talk about in the book, reduce that number for ourselves and the people around us. How much should we learn talking about how smart, special, wonderful we are? Nothing. Or listening to someone do this? Nothing. How much should we learn talking about how bad, stupid, or inept other people are? Nothing. How much of our lives are wasted on that? Way, way too much. I listen to these call-in radio shows sometimes. I can't believe it. People are screaming and yelling and making themselves angry over football coaches. A football coach doesn't care about you. A football coach is not listening to the show. What a waste of energy and time and negative mojo, nojo. For what? For absolutely nothing. Well, if it doesn't matter, don't do it. Do what counts. What doesn't count, take a deep breath. Let it go. Thank
great.
You.
Great answer. Do we have another verbal question? I got a couple online.
Fire away.
So somebody wanted you to talk about your previous book, if you could talk about what got you here won't get you there. They just loved the book and wanted to hear more about it.
Well, in my previous book, I do a few things. I talk about Peter Drucker. Again, I learned a lot from Peter Drucker. I feel very blessed to have spent 50 days with him. Peter Drucker said we spend a lot of time teaching leaders what to do. We do not spend enough time teaching leaders what to stop. He said half the leaders I meet, they don't need to learn what to do. They need to learn what to stop. So the first thing I do is I talk about habits that can hold you back. The first habit I talk about in that book is winning too much. And what's that mean? If it's important, we want to win. If it's meaningful, we want to win. If it's trivial, we want to win. If it's not worth it, we want to win anyway. I talk about why winners always need to win. And I use a case study. Yet 75% of my successful clients fail. Most of the listeners will fail. You want to go to dinner at restaurant X? Your husband, wife, partner, significant other wants to go to dinner at restaurant Y. If you need a heated argument, you go to restaurant Y. It was not your choice. Food tastes awful. Service is terrible. Option A, critique the food, point out our partner was wrong. This mistake could have been avoided had only they listened to me. Option B, shut up. eat the stupid food, try to enjoy it, and have a nice evening. What would I do? What should I do? 75% of the people I work with, what would I do? Critique the food. What should I do? Shut up. Well, I talk about what not to do, a lot of the classic problems of smart, successful people. Then I talk about how to change behavior. And again, my coaching process is very unique. I have everyone get feedback. They publicly apologize for what they've done wrong. They tell the world what they're trying to improve. They learn to listen in a non-defensive way, thank people and not shoot the messenger, and then follow up on a rigorous basis. And my whole coaching philosophy is based on something called feed forward. Again, a very Buddhist philosophy. Buddhists said only do what I teach if it works in the context of your own life. How does feed forward work? Well, you learn to ask for input, listen to it, and treat it as a gift. You say thank you. You don't promise to do everything, but you listen, you learn, you change what you can. And again, if anyone online would like to see the research study, my partner Howard Morgan and I did a research study with 86,000 participants in 8 major companies, which was published in the Journal of Strategy and Business. And we documented how leaders that get feedback, do what we talk about, publicly acknowledge what they want to work on, practice feed forward, follow up on a regular basis, how they get better, and they're perceived as becoming more effective, not just by themselves, but everyone around them. We also document how leaders that just go to classes or get feedback but don't do any follow-up might as well be watching sitcoms. By the way, and they don't get better at all. And by the way, when my book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, was the number one best-selling business book in the United States, number one selling diet book, sold 10 times as many copies. It was written by Dr. Oz. When my book, Mojo, was the number two best-selling business book in the United States, number one diet book written by Alicia Silverstone, The Kind Diet, probably sold 5 times as many copies. Americans get fatter and fatter and fatter and more diet books. Buying diet books doesn't make you thin. If buying diet books would make you thin, Americans would be the thinnest people in the history of the world. You don't lose weight by buying diet books. You could go on a diet. Now, I did make one mistake with my book, Mojo. The title is called Mojo, How to Get It, How to Keep It, How to Get It Back If You Lose It. Not a bad title. You know what I should have called this stupid book? Mojo the Diet. Then I would have really sold a lot of copies.
What was that publishing company thinking about when they published that book?
Mojo the Diet. That would have been better.
So I got a couple other questions, but does anyone have a question they want to ask verbally? Okay, so this was I'm almost not going to read this one, but okay, if you're a Marshall Goldsmith or a Mitchell Levy, I could see how you could make your mojo happen, but I am not in the station of life where I feel I can make that happen. What should I do?
Well, number one, look in a mirror. Dennis Mudd, that person I mentioned, he's a roofer in Valley Station, Kentucky. That woman sitting next to me was a flight attendant. You don't have to be in some fancy job to have mojo. When I was brought up in Valley Station, Kentucky, we were all poor. A lot of people had positive mojo, and a lot of people didn't. What you can do is every day look in that mirror and ask yourself, how can I make the best of now? How can I make the best of now? You can't change what you can't change. Let me give you a couple of suggestions that I'm kind of reading between the lines. This is something you may not have done yet. Number one, I don't think you've forgiven other people for being who they are or forgiven the world for being what it is. And then number two, you probably haven't forgiven yourself for being who you are. Well, you know, try to forgive other people for being who they are. You don't have to like them or agree with them or respect them. The main reason you want to forgive them is not for their needs, it's for your needs. Forgive yourself for being who you are. You are where you are. You're in whatever station you're in. That's something you're not going to change right this second. What can you do to accept where you are and then say, how can I make the best of where I am? Then focus on moving forward to go where I can go.
That's a pretty profound advice. Appreciate that.
Hey, Mitch, John, I'd like to ask a question.
Please.
Fire away, John.
What you say sounds very interesting. How do you maintain that? I can see how an individual could start down that path and, you know, do it successfully for 2 weeks, but how do you sustain it over time?
Well, number one, you see, you're falling into the Great Western Trap. The Great Western Trap is when I say mojo is that positive spirit toward what you're doing now that starts on the inside and radiates to the outside, or Buddhism. the essence of life is find happiness and contentment now. The first Western reaction is to extrapolate now to eternity and say, how can I do that forever? The reality is you can't do it forever. According to Buddhism, there's only 1 second in time you need to learn to find happiness and contentment. You know when that is? Now. Well, rather than getting fixated on forever, focus on day to day, minute to minute, hour to hour. Why do I have that coach call me up and remind me of stuff? You know why? Because I'm busy. Why do I have the mojo meter to remind me to what I'm doing? Because I'm busy. There's a great book called The Checklist Manifesto written by Dr. Atul Gawande, who's a professor at Harvard Medical School. You know what he says? Very intelligent, busy people don't need checklists less, they need them more. Why? We get lost. Now, why don't we do what we know we should? In my research that I did with my partner, Howard Morgan, let me give you an example. Johnson & Johnson is my biggest customer. 2,000 people that year went to my program for Johnson & Johnson, their top 2,000 leaders. At the end of my program, and I talk about this and what got you here won't get you there, I asked them, are you going to do what Marshall just taught you? 98% of their leaders said yes. A year later, 70% had done something, and 30% had done absolutely zero, not even 1 minute. Now, I'm not ashamed of these numbers. I'm proud of these numbers. 70% did something. That's 1,400 people getting evaluated by an average of 10 direct reports each. 14,000 people have a little bit better life. I'm not ashamed of that. I'm proud of this. I got even better news. 30% that did nothing didn't get worse. Well, I got to talk to people who did nothing. Back to your question, ask them, why don't you do this stuff? The answer had nothing to do with ethics or integrity. Johnson & Johnson won an award that year, most ethical company in the world. Had nothing to do with intelligence. They're smart people. They're good people. Why didn't they do it? Had to do with a dream. This is a dream I've had for years, and I'm going to make a prediction. I predict you've had this dream. In fact, I predict you've had the same dream on a recurring basis for years. What's the dream sound like? You know, I'm incredibly busy right now. Given pressures of work and home and new technology, I'm about as busy as I ever have been. Sometimes I feel overcommitted. I don't tell others this, but every now and again, my life's a little out of control. But you know, I'm working on some very unique and special challenges right now. I think the worst of this can be over in 4 or 5 months. After that, I'm going to take 2 or 3 weeks and get organized and spend some time with the family, and I'm going to begin my new healthy life program. And after that, everything's going to be different, and it won't be crazy anymore. Well, how many people have ever had that dream? Pretty much all of us. The thing I've learned in life is there ain't going to be no 2 or 3 weeks. Sanity's never going to kick in. Tomorrow's going to be just crazy as today. We want to do something different, look in the mirror and say, what am I willing to do now? Just do that. And all that other stuff, take a deep breath. Let it go. Let it go. Good question. Next question.
You know, we got one online. It was sort of a thank you for the previous answer that you gave. But the follow-up is, do you have any stories for people who really felt hopeless? I'm trying to read between the lines. And change their life.
Well, I'll give you a story of a person who felt angry, whose mojo score was not low on meaning, but was low on happiness and making everybody else miserable. Did you ever see the movie Wall Street?
Yes.
I was the coach for the real-life role model for Gordon Gekko in Wall Street.
No kidding.
Yep, Michael Douglas, the actor, followed this guy around to learn how to act like an arrogant ass. His score on treating people with respect from both direct reports and coworkers, 0.1 percentile. I talked to the guy, and I reviewed his feedback, and I said, 0.1 is not real high. I said, how do you treat people at home? Oh, he said, I'm totally different at home. I said, are you single or married? He said, I'm married. I said, good, let's call your wife right now and read her these scores. His wife said, you're a jerk. I said, let's check in with the kiddies. Jerk. Jerk. I looked at the guy. I said, a pattern's beginning to emerge. I said, I can't help you make money. You're already making more than God, but I got a question. You want to have a funeral that nobody shows up for other than business reasons? He looked at me and said, I'm going to change. Not because of you or this company or money. I'm going to change because I got a 13-year-old son. 30 years from today, if a man like you read a report like that about my son, I'd be ashamed he was my son. He looked at me and said, my son acts this way now. I wonder where he picked that up. In 1 year, he got ranked at 53.7 percentile in terms of treating people with respect. And you know what's more important? He was a whole lot happier. He wasn't angry or bitter or cynical. He got a whole lot happier. So you know what? Anybody can change. You just got to, anybody can change, but it's got to come from the inside, not from the outside. The greatest leaders I've ever met in my life, one of them, General Eric Shinseki. He's formerly head of the United States Army. Now he's head of Veterans Affairs. Wonderful human being. He got shot twice. Pretty much got his leg blown off. Let me ask you a question. How much whining and complaining do you think he did when he got his leg blown off? I can answer that question. Zero. He probably just apologized because he wasn't able to complete the mission. Well, I was with Alan Mulally, who's now the CEO of Ford Motor Company, after 9/11. A tragedy for him and his company, Boeing. He ran Boeing Commercial Aircraft. You know what he said? Great leaders don't get paid for what they do when times are good. They get paid for what they do when times are tough. So, to me, if you want to look at mojo, think about when times are tough. What can you do to be a great role model when times are tough? It's easy to be a great role model when times are easy. It's hard when times are tough. And by the way, I'm not naive. I know it's hard out there today for many people. It's hard out there for many, many people. You've got to just say, how can I do the best I can do under the situations I'm in? How can I sell what I can sell? How can I go out there day after day after day and bust it to do what I need to do to take care of myself and my family? And by the way, is it easy? No, I didn't say anything in this book is easy. It's not easy. Our default reaction in life is not happiness or meaning. It's inertia. But that inertia will kill you. I feel bad. I'm down and out. I don't feel like applying for that job today. I feel bad. I'm kind of down at the gills. I don't feel like being positive at work today. Well, that kind of inertia is what kills mojo and ultimately kills our careers.
So do me again. What is the easiest way to sort of stop inertia?
Easiest way
to stop
inertia.
Going back to the name and frame it.
Well, that's what I use for the mojo meter. Every meeting, imagine you're going to evaluate yourself. How happy was I? How meaningful was this? Over and over and over, you start evaluating yourself. And you start creating happiness and meaning in your life rather than waiting for happiness and meaning to show up.
Yeah, actually, you know, just asking that question is increasing your awareness of making it happen.
That's right. And by the way, what did Buddha say? Buddha said, I'm not a god, I'm just a human. I am awake. So part of this is just wake up.
We have time for one more question, if anyone has one verbal. If not, I've got one.
Oh, I've got a final exercise for everybody.
Oh, please.
Are you ready? Here's my favorite exercise. Take a deep breath. Take a deeper breath.
Do I have to make a verbal deep breath?
I want everybody online to imagine you're 95 years old. You're just getting ready to die. You're on that deathbed. Here comes your last breath. But before you take that last breath, you're given a wonderful gift, the ability to go back in time and talk to the person listening to you right now. What advice would the wise 95-year-old you, who knows what was really important in life and what wasn't and what matters and what doesn't matter, what advice would that old person have for the you that's listening to me right now? No, take a deep breath and figure out what that is for you. Whatever that is for you, do that. Have that answer come from the inside, not from the outside. A friend of mine interviewed old folks who were dying, got to ask him this question. Three themes come up. Theme number one could be summarized in three words. Be happy now. Not next week, not next month, not next year. The great Western disease, I'll be happy when. When I get the status, the money, the condominium, the BMW, I will be happy when. I live in a beautiful neighborhood called Fairbanks Ranch in Rancho Santa Fe, California. One of my neighbors was a man named Ray Kroc, founder of McDonald's. He died and left the big house to his wife, Joan Kroc. I'm driving by the big house with my friend Lisa. She's 24. She looked up the hill and said, I wish I could trade places with Joan Kroc. Joan Kroc's got billions of dollars in his big old house. She's got it all. I said, Lisa, you're 24. She's 74. Go knock on the door and say, Joan, you give me all that crap, I'm giving you 50 years. You know what Joan Kroc would be saying? Sold. You know what
you're
trade
absolutely
with her.
Right.
You don't want to trade with her. She wants to trade with you. Joan Kroc's dead now. She's not dead. Bad trade. Don't get so wrapped up looking at what you don't have. You miss what you do have. I've asked tens of thousands of parents around the world this question. When my child grows up, I want my child to be. One word comes up in the answer from parents more than every other word combined, no matter what country I'm in. What's that word? Happy.
Happy, yeah.
You want your kid to be happy? You want your parents to be happy? You want the people that love you to be happy? You want the people who respect you at work to be happy? You go first.
Hey, you know, that's why we named our company Happy About.
Good name. Second advice from old people facing death, people. Do whatever you can to build relationships with people, help people at work and at home. Main reason to do that is nothing to do with status or money. 95-year-old you is going to be proud of you because you did. Disappointed if you don't. The final factor from old people facing death is go for it. Life is short. You do what you think is right. You may not win. At least you'll look in the mirror and say, what the heck, at least I tried. Old people seldom regret the risk they took and failed. They almost always regret the risk they failed to take. And the final thing I'd like to say is I had a great time working with everybody on this call. Hope some of the listeners found it to be positive and useful and have a little bit better life.
Marshall, I appreciate that. For those that are listening and those that listen to the follow-on podcast, which we'll place this on our website as well, I encourage you to make a calendar mark. Go into your calendar today, whether you're going to do it tonight or you're going to do it on next Friday. Put a mark in your calendar, or do it Saturday or Sunday with your spouse, where you actually are asking yourself the question Marshall asked you. I've asked that question to myself a couple times, and you really need to sit down and think it through and come up with a result. And then as soon as you answer that question, I agree, make it happen. Write down what you're going to do. Write down what you would change, and then start moving forward. If you want to get reminded on the concepts, the book Mojo is available at Amazon and through bookstores worldwide, as well as the book Mojo Tweet. There's a pound sign in front of it, so pound Mojo Tweet. And that's available also on Amazon, Happy About, Think Aha, and other locations. Marshall, it's been fantastic, as I expected. I appreciate your contribution to the world and look forward to working with you on the next set of books.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, and thank you, everyone, for participating today.